Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Our quote for the day from Albert Einstein: everything that is really great and inspiring is created by the individual who can labor in freedom. Freedom, our theme for the day. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome to the program. In our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment, the third hour of our program, Paul Fitzgerald is here on killer cell phones, what the telecommunications industry doesn't want you to know. And Jeffrey Feldman will be here in the second hour of our program from Frame Shop is Open about the latest frames, Republican and Democratic, that are being thrown out there into the memosphere, into the framosphere, into the world. And speaking about frames, the confluence of the let's be afraid of gays frame and the let's be afraid of terrorists frame is being prominently featured right now over at Cybercast News Service, the conservative CNSNews.com website. Jeff Johnson wrote an article, Dem Altered Immigration Law to Further Gay Agenda. Jeff Johnson with us on the phone here. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure to be your punching bag once again.
Jeff, why? You can punch back pretty good, Jeff. Why do you guys insist on lying about Barney Frank and trashing gays? I mean, and is this?
I would interrupt you to say that we're not doing either. First of all, almost everything that's said about Barney Frank in the story is a quote from a chapter in a book written by Barney Frank. The one thing, if you want to call it a lie, you're going to have to attribute it to the person who said it, and that's his opponent, Chuck Morse, not us. We're merely quoting the two people who are contending for the seat. So if you're going to call somebody a liar, call the right person a liar, okay?
Well, Chuck Morse is somebody that I've known for a number of years. He's been on the program many times, and we've had these conversations, perhaps we should be having this one with him. By the way, Jeff, if you're on a speakerphone, please pick up the phone.
No, I'm sorry. I'm on a headset. I'll move the microphone a little bit. Is that
okay?
Better?
It's getting there. Just to, you know, be a whole lot better if it was a real phone. Barney Frank has issued a couple of memorandums here, where he says several of my right-wing opponents have claimed that I sponsored an amendment to U.S. immigration law which says a visa could only be denied if the government could prove that the applicant had committed an act of terrorism. This is a lie. It is completely and utterly untrue. I have never offered any such language, and no such language appears in any immigration bill that I have seen. He says, we specifically exempted people accused of terrorism from the right to enter. What he's trying to do is prevent the government from discriminating against gays who want to legally enter the United States. What's wrong with that?
Well, what he originally claimed he was trying to do was prohibit the government from discriminating against people who disagreed with the government. And the revelation, if you will, in the story, the part of this story that was not really well publicly known, was something that I discovered while I was investigating the charges made by Frank's opponent, Chuck Morse. And I will note that the quotes you read from Barney Frank are also his defense of the legislation he introduced is included in my article. What wasn't widely publicly known was that while Congressman Frank was out on numerous occasions saying things like he made the changes in the immigration law because he thought they were unduly restrictive on political grounds with people coming in, or he worked to change a law that permitted American officials to refuse to allow people into America because we didn't like their political opinions. What he later on in this chapter in Creating Change, which is basically a political how-to book for enacting the homosexual agenda, he admitted that his primary motivation was to remove the prohibition on homosexuals immigrating to or visiting the United States.
Right. So why does that so frighten you, Jeff?
It doesn't frighten me at all.
Why do you oppose that? Why do you call that the homosexual agenda? I mean, we're talking about human rights here. We're talking about civil rights. What's wrong with that?
No, we're talking about immigration law, and we're talking about a legislator who wanted to make a minor change to immigration law, minor in the scope of all of the people who were prohibited from coming in. There was one class of people that he wanted to change and allow them to enter the country. Rather
that being
than
gays.
Doing that, rather than setting forward and saying, this is what I'd like to change, he made a broad sweeping change because, as he admits in the chapter in the book, and we quote from that in the story, he knew that if he came forward and tried to merely repeal the prohibition on homosexual immigration, that would not pass. the question that I come to is, if you know that the elected representatives of the people of this country are not going to do something, why don't you try to sneak it through? And hey, look, both sides are guilty of this. All 17 sides are guilty of this. Everybody tries to stick their little thing that they know is not going to be popular, be it their little tax increase or their little tax credit for their friend in a big corporation, into a...
Well, it's a little different. You're accusing Barney Frank of helping terrorists here, and you read this legislation...
Barney Frank of helping terrorists, Tom. Chuck Morris is accusing Barney Frank of helping...
Right, and you're reporting
it. I'm reporting the news.
Okay.
Repetitions in the right direction, okay?
Yeah. Well, in that case, Jeff, you know, if you don't have an opinion on this, is this what you're saying?
Oh, I have an opinion on it. I have an opinion on the fact that Chuck Morris seems to be making these accusations, though there are a lot of people out there, including Tom Keene, the co-chairman of the 9/11 Commission, who disagree with him and say Barney Frank didn't have anything to do, Barney Frank's legislation didn't have anything to do with the 9/11 terrorists getting in. But I also have an opinion on Barney Frank or any other legislator who tries to do something covertly by sneaking a piece of legislation. Walk up to the podium, tell us what you want to do, and then let's put it out on the floor of the House or the floor of the Senate.
But Barney Frank's legislation just says you can't discriminate on when you're talking about somebody coming into this country as a tourist or as a student or any other kind of legal visa.
Or immigrating to the country.
You can't discriminate based on their political viewpoints. Tom,
that's not all it says. Prior to the Frank Amendment being passed, there was a long list of people who were excluded from entering the United States. Among those were people who had been involved in activities like protest against the United States, participation in activities. These were the three of the classes that Representative Frank very much objected to. Participation in activities that would be prejudicial to the public interest or public safety, membership in a subversive organization, or teaching or advocating subversive views, and the likelihood of engaging in subversive activities after entry into the country. Now, those were the things that he got up on the floor of the House and pounded his fist on the podium.
Right, and none of this has to do with terrorism. This has to do with what's called subversive activity, which is, and this is the weird confluence that you guys are always making when you have conservatives in charge of the government or Republicans in charge of the government. You say when anybody speaks out against the Republicans, if somebody speaks out against Richard Nixon's Vietnam policy, they're speaking out against the government. If they were speaking out against LBJ's Vietnam policy, they're speaking out against the Johnson administration. I mean, one man's subversion is another man's, political opinion.
But the point being, there were all of these groups of people who were excluded from entering the United States. Barney Frank's legislation changed that to say, unless you have done A, B, or C, you cannot be excluded from the United States. And essentially, A, B, and C are committing a criminal act that would be a felony if you were convicted of it here in the United States, a public health risk, something like if you have tuberculosis or something of that nature, or active participation in the planning or execution of a terrorist act.
So now, what's wrong? That seems quite reasonable to me, Jeff Johnson.
May seem quite reasonable.
You don't want somebody to be allowed into the United States because they were what? A member of the Communist Party of East Germany or something?
There are people who feel that way. And Barney Frank didn't, this is the point of the whole article. Barney Frank didn't come forward and say, hey, I think it's wrong that we exclude homosexuals from the United States, so I'm introducing it.
But that wasn't his only concern.
But he admits freely that was his primary and overwhelming concern, and that he essentially used the fairness and First Amendment arguments on subversive political thought and things of that nature as a smokescreen to get...
But if it is fair, and it does represent the First Amendment, and it does represent real and traditional American values, why are you objecting to it?
I'm objecting to Barney Frank being misleading about what he was trying to accomplish.
But you don't object to his legislation?
I think it has a pure motivation if you're talking about the exchange, free exchange of ideas. I don't think necessarily that it's a good idea to allow someone who has stood up, say, in a public square in Iran and screamed death to America and we should nuke America and those kinds of things to come over here and spread that hate.
Then we end up like the Soviet Union.
I think this is the best way to answer your question. I do not believe that people who are non citizens of the United States enjoy the same freedoms and protections as those who are citizens of the United States.
Well, I'm not suggesting that they should. I mean, there certainly is a difference between citizenship and non-citizenship. But the First Amendment of the United States does not say just for citizens.
Actually, the First Amendment to the Constitution of the United States, it becomes a part of the Constitution, which begins with the phrase, "We the people of the United States of America."
Enact this Constitution, but it doesn't say that it just applies to citizens. There's nothing in the Constitution that says it only applies to citizens other than the 14th Amendment.
The Supreme Court agrees with you. I disagree with you.
Okay. I guess I am. Jeff Johnson, Cybercast News Service, CNSNews.com. Thanks, Jeff, for being on the program.
Thank you, Tom.
16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Remember, democracy starts with you. Tag your ears.
And welcome back to the place where being progressive never felt so good. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Just to kind of summarize what happened in the last segment, Congressman Barney Frank of Massachusetts has proposed, actually it's been passed, the Frank Amendment legislation that basically says you can't deny somebody entry into the United States because you don't like their point of view, their politics. And it also knocked down the, you can't allow somebody to the United States because they happen to be gay. And some folks are upset about that, mostly Barney Frank's opponent, Chuck Morse, the Republican who's running against him for the House of Representatives. In Massachusetts. We've had Chuck on the program many times in the past. Oh, it's been probably about a year since he's been on. Probably ought to get him on again and see where we go with this thing. But anyhow, welcome back to the program. The category of Democrats playing checkers, Republicans playing chess. This really hit me this morning over at one of the progressive websites. I'm not going to name it because, you know, I don't want to sound like I'm trashing it, but I just do a reality check here with me on this thing. Ralph Reed, the Georgia Republican who started the Christian Coalition, or was at least one of the leaders of it, and, you know, has always marketed himself as, you know, Mr. Squeaky Clean, uber Christian. In the midst of this campaign to run for the Republican, for the opportunity to be the Republican candidate for the Lieutenant Governor of Georgia. In other words, this is the Republican primary in Georgia. In the midst of this campaign, it comes out that Ralph Reed has basically been in bed with Jack Abramoff for a long, long time, and that they had this scheme to do, you know, life insurance on elderly black people to try and get their money, and he was taking money from Indian tribes, and, you know, yada, yada, yada. And so what happened was Reed lost. He lost. And now there's a Republican that's going to be running against the Democrat. I believe the Democrat's Kathy Cox, the former attorney general. I might be wrong on that. But in any case, now there's going to be a Republican running for lieutenant governor who's not Ralph Reed, who doesn't have the Jack Abramoff baggage. And this website says, this progressive website, unable to distance himself from scandal-tarred lobbyist Jack Abramoff, Reed conceded defeat in Georgia's Republican race for lieutenant governor. Celebrate the good times, come on. And they've got a picture of a graphic of fireworks going off. I'm sorry, this isn't good times in my book. And this kind of falls into the same category as why is it that, I believe it was yesterday, maybe it was the day before, Hillary Clinton's having breakfast privately with Rupert Murdoch. And, you know, what's Rupert Murdoch up to here? And if you look at the Republicans, the way that they play chess, they decide in advance who they want to run against based on who they think they can beat. I mean, Richard Nixon was the master of this. Back in the, what was it, the election of 72, I think, or was it 68? It must have been 72. Nixon knew that he could beat McGovern. I mean, they did the polls. He knew he could beat McGovern. he knew he also could not beat Ed Muskie. Ed Muskie would trounce him. Ed Muskie was a statesman. He was a brilliant senator, the senator from Maine, a competent public speaker. He had the issues on his side. He was great. And so Nixon sends Chuck Colson and a Dirty Tricks crew up to New Hampshire, where Ed Muskie's campaigning, and they steal some campaign letterhead, and they forge this letter in which they refer to French ancestry Americans as Canucks, which is a slur in New Hampshire, and there's a lot of French Canadians ancestry citizens of New Hampshire. In fact, they're very prominently represented in the Democratic Party up there. And the letter gets published as if it were real on the front page of the Manchester Union Leader, which is owned by, was at the time, by Bill Loeb. He's dead now. And he used to run editorials, screaming, raging right-wing editorials on the front page. And Ed Muskie gets up to rebut it. And the story is that one of Nixon's Dirty Tricks guy, in addition to setting Muskie up for this thing, and this is one of several, by the way, dirty tricks that they played on Ed Muskie, in addition to setting it up for, he slipped something into his coffee. You know, I've heard a couple of different drugs mentioned, LSD among others. And so Muskie gets up on the back of this flatbed truck, this trailer truck, and truck anyhow, and to address the issue, starts talking about his wife and starts crying. He's really upset. And boom, he's gone. I mean, Nixon takes out Muskie. He sends his Dirty Tricks crowd up there to take out Muskie. Why? Because he wanted to run against McGovern. And I don't think it's a good thing for the Democrats to say, isn't this great? Ralph Reed just lost the Republican primary, because Ralph Reed would have been the perfect guy to run against in the general election. Now, the Democrat from Georgia, who's running for the lieutenant governor, is going to have to run against a clean, relatively speaking, Republican. I mean, I realize it's a bit of an oxymoron, but to the extent that it's possible, at least to a Republican who doesn't have the baggage of Jack Abramoff, it's going to be a lot harder, frankly, than it would have been to beat Ralph Reed. And so it concerns me when I see Democrats playing checkers while the Republicans are playing chess. I think we need to be thinking two and three steps ahead. And perhaps, you know, this is a premature victory. So just, you know, my two cents worth. I think that broadly speaking, if we're going to look at political stuff, we ought to look at it in a little more sophisticated way or larger worldview. We'll be back with that. Stem cells. Marriott is going non-smoking. Is it time to think the unthinkable? What about these folks who have been arrested for murder down in New Orleans? Right after this, 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
I got news of the very best kind about troubles that are falling behind about people that used to be blind till they opened up their eyes to see. It's news when they begin to ask why they're poor until the day that they die they're tired of pie in the sky and they want some security. And it's news, news, ain't that news, ain't that something to see. News, talk about the news, it's mighty good news to me.
And welcome back, 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS. 915 days, 12 hours, 24 minutes, 58 seconds until George W. Bush voluntarily leaves office, barring impeachment, which might be sooner than you think if the Democrats get control of the House and the Senate. And isn't it interesting how the Republicans have stopped hysterically bloviating about that? I think it's also interesting that commentators, the mainstream media, has pretty much already set up the 2008 presidential election. Certainly Chris Matthews has, and I think the meme is spreading all through the mainstream corporate media, particularly that owned by General Electric, that the 2008 election should be between Hillary Clinton and Rudy Giuliani. And presumably because they believe that Rudy Giuliani can beat Hillary Clinton. So, you know, we'll see how this thing shakes out. But I just find it fascinating. Kudos to Dennis Kucinich. Congratulations to Dennis Kucinich. Our done a marvelous thing. In fact, here's our Jolly Good Fellow award. Dennis Kucinich is introduced in the House of Representatives, a concurrent resolution calling on the president to appeal to all sides in the current crisis in the Middle East. I'm reading from the resolution itself. For an immediate cessation of violence. And to commit United States diplomats to multi-party negotiations with no preconditions. And it's just very, very simple. This thing runs 16 lines long. And appeal to all sides in the current crisis for an immediate cessation of violence. A, B, commit U.S. diplomats to multi-party negotiations with no preconditions. And C, send a high-level diplomatic mission to the region to facilitate such multi-party negotiations. But apparently Condi still has to buy some shoes before she can head out of town to take care of this. In New Orleans, a doctor and two nurses have been arrested and charged with felony murder, second-degree murder. Dr. Anna Powell, nurses Cheryl Landry and Lori Budo, for giving lethal doses of morphine and a sedative, midazolam, which is in the benzodiazepine family, it's sort of like Valium, to four patients. And the state attorney general, Charles Foti, he says, we're not calling this euthanasia, we're not calling these mercy killings, this is second-degree murder. These were people who were dying. These were people who had do not resuscitate, on their record. They had signed DNR agreements, said do not resuscitate me. They were in the final stages of dying. They were in the hospital. 4 days had gone by, and the Bush administration had completely ignored them. This was the public hospital, so it's where the poorer people were, so they were the last to be rescued. The waters were rising. The power had been shut off. The ventilating machines were going down. They were running out of supplies and running out of drugs. The temperatures were over 100 degrees. And you had people who were actively in the process of dying. And apparently, if the charges are right, these four patients, this doctor and these two nurses, sped up their dying a little bit by giving them morphine and one of these benzodiazepine drugs, midazolam. And this is an issue that the United States has to confront. Here in Oregon, we have the Death with Dignity Law, which the Right to Lifers fought tooth and nail, but it was passed by ballot initiative. The people of the state of Oregon passed the thing, saying that doctors can prescribe life-ending medication to patients. You have to have two doctors sign off on it. You have to be within 6 months of death, and you have to have a terminal diagnosis, of course. But we're the only state that does that. And no state allows a doctor to make this kind of difficult decision. Here you have somebody, the water is rising. These people are going to either, A, die without ventilators and without medication because everybody else is evacuating, and they're not going to evacuate dying people. That decision had already been made, but way above the pay grade of this doctor and these two nurses. So these people, the medications are going to wear off, and they're going to die in excruciating pain, or they're going to drown in the floodwaters. Or B, they're going to hang on for a day or two and die anyway, and they're in the process of actively dying, and they're in a lot of pain. Or C, you can slightly increase the dose of morphine that they're already on and push them over the edge, and off they go into that great light, or whatever it is that we all go into. And first of all, I think it's a crime that this doctor and these two nurses have been arrested, my personal take on this. And I think that they should get a medal for having made a very, very difficult decision and having spared these four patients the pain of drowning to death or of dying without pain medication and without ventilators. And secondly, I think that this should provide the United States with an opportunity to visit some of the issues that other countries around the world are visiting in a very real way. For example, this would not have been a crime in Holland, in the Netherlands. So you have something that would not be a crime in the Netherlands, but is a crime here. And so, anyhow, your thoughts on this and other issues of the day. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. And, of course, you can drop into our live chat room by going to tomhartmann.com and clicking live chat. Rich in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Rich, hang on just a second. I gotta set up my phone here and get into a mode where I can push buttons. There we go. Okay, Rich in Columbus, Ohio. Where'd it go? There we go. Rich, what's up?
Hey, I got two quick things for you. You got a great show, Tom.
Thank you, Rich.
Hey, it really seems kind of hypocritical that the Republicans like to come out and pick out one little thing that the Democrats want to pass, but they never mention anything about the hidden agenda that got us into a war in Iraq, and also another piece of legislation with the guest worker program. If that ever passes, they're going to allow more people in this country under the guise of farm workers and everything. But they don't tell you that as soon as they're allowed to come here, they can apply for any job. They don't have to stay on the farm and work.
Right. Well, I don't even think that they're making the pretense of this being for farm workers. I mean, you got the construction industry, you know, gung-ho on this thing. Meatpacking industry gung-ho on this thing. It seems like they're not even making that pretense anymore. What they're going to try and do is they're going to pass it with it's probably going to fail in the House, but in the Senate what they did was they passed it with a majority of the Republicans voting in favor of it, and they blamed it on the Democrats, and they're going to use it in the elections to blame the Democrats for it.
Yeah, and the other thing I think it's really disgusting that the president's going to use his first veto to maybe hasten the end of my life. I just got diagnosed a year ago with Parkinson's, and pretty soon I won't be able to continue in my job. And,
I'm sorry to hear that, Rich.
With stem cell research, you know, there's a little bit of an outlook. But
yeah. Well, Rich, we're all fighting for you. And I'm sorry to hear about your diagnosis, but we all need to be contacting our legislators. And see, on the one hand, it's like call President Bush and tell him not to veto the bill. Well, you could do that. It's not going to work because Karl Rove is already out there lying about the science on this. I mean, literally lying about the science, saying that there are scientists who say that adult stem cells can be used just like fetal stem cells. And then the question was, okay, Mr. Rove, who is this scientist? Well, we don't have a name. We're not going to answer that question. So number one, the White House is already lying about it. But the fact of the matter is this passed the Senate with 63 votes. After Bush vetoes it, it's going to go back to the Senate. It's going to take 66 votes to override that veto. Three more senators need to change their votes. And
I know our senator. I'm from Pennsylvania. I know our senator, Sam Farm. He's not going to change his mind, so hopefully he'll be gone soon.
Yeah, there you go. Rich, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And good luck in your battle with this illness. That's a tough one. That's a tough one. Stuart in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Stuart, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you. Tom, when you went from Rupert Murdoch, that is the head of Fox Broadcasting, supporting Hillary Clinton, to the Republicans choosing who they want because they want someone they can beat, I think you had it wrong.
Okay.
Hillary would be a perfectly good choice for the plutocrats, the billionaire power brokers, almost as well as any Republican.
That's the thing. I don't disagree with you, and there's two possibilities here. One is that Murdoch is backing Hillary because he's pretty sure she's going to be the candidate in 2008, and he thinks there's a good chance she's going to win, and he wants to have a president in his back pocket or at least be friends with one. And that just makes good business sense and good political sense. Or the other could be that he's backing Hillary because he's really backing Rudy Giuliani, and he thinks that Giuliani can beat Hillary. I don't know which is true.
Well, I think he'd be very happy if he couldn't get Rudy Giuliani. He'd be very happy with Hillary. She supports the war. She supports so-called free trade, which gets rid of all of our environmental safety and labor laws. And she supports this Israeli violence, unended violence against the Lebanese and the...
So the bottom line here is that Murdoch wins no matter what. If Hillary becomes president, Murdoch wins, and if Hillary loses, and Giuliani or some other, you know, McCain or some other Republican becomes president, then Murdoch wins too. So interesting point, Stuart. Lee in Houston, Texas. Hey, Lee, we just have about a half a minute here before we got to take a break. What's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, maybe you can talk about this. I'll let you go. I was curious. Yesterday I saw that Alberto Gonzalez admitted that George Bush personally put down the investigation by the Department of Justice into the illegal wiretapping of Americans.
Right.
I just can't understand why people aren't out of the streets today freaking out. There's obviously no checks and balances if this type of thing is going on.
Yeah.
I'll go ahead and get off and let you talk about it.
No, you're absolutely right, Lee. You're absolutely right.
Why wasn't OPR given clearance, as so many other lawyers in the Department of Justice were given clearance?
Mr. Chairman, you and I had lunch.
This is Alberto Gonzalez. He goes through this whole thing, and the bottom line, he says, was it the president who did it? Yeah.
As with all decisions that are non-operational in terms of who has access to the program, the President of the United States makes the decision.
Yeah. So the president decided not to have his own branch investigate himself. Now, I agree. We should be on the streets. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I cleared the rocks and timber from the wild New England shore. I labored long and hard to make it grow. I built the first log cabins and I raised a family. Told King George and all his redcoats where to go. I'm the man that built the bridges, I'm the man that laid the track. I'm the man that built this country with my shoulders and my back. I'm the man that built the power dams and oiled all the cars. And I laid down the cornerstone for this great land of ours. I'm the boy that drove the wagons when the people headed west, dug canals and pulled the barges on their way.
Oh, but I thought it was only the big businessmen and the capitalists and John Galt who built America. Of course, John Galt was working for the railroad when he invented that engine. Didn't they own it? A little problem in Ayn Rand's story. Anyway, welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. News without conflicts of global corporate interest, the Tom Hartman radio program, 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number, Karen in Federal Way, Washington. Hey, Karen, you disagree with me.
I disagree. No, I don't disagree with you. I'm just saying, you know, if they're going to try those people on murder charges.
We're talking about the doctor and the two nurses in New Orleans.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, I forgot to refer to that. What about bringing in their accomplices like George Bush, Mr. Chertoff, and Michael Brown?
I mean, yes.
So, I mean, you know, go ahead and charge them, but charge their accomplices too.
Yes, 4 days all alone in a public hospital with no electricity, the ventilators going down, running out of drugs. You got people who are dying. They're on death's door and do not resuscitate. They will not be evacuated under any circumstances. And what do you do? I mean, this has got to be one of the most difficult decisions that a physician could ever possibly face. And we want to throw these people in jail?
Yeah, I would not want to be in that position.
Yeah, I would not either. And the fact that they stayed there, and they stayed for 4 days with these patients, I mean, they should be getting the Congressional Medal of Honor. And instead, this Louisiana State Attorney General Charles Foti, who I would like to know a little more about this guy. You know, is he part of the Right to Life movement? Is he in bed with Ralph Reed? I mean, what's the deal here? Because he's here's a quote from him. He says, "We're not calling this euthanasia. We're not calling this mercy killings. This is second degree murder." And I'm sorry, these were, speaking the mother of one of the physicians, of the physician, Jeanette Powell, her mother, she says, medicine was the most important thing in her life. I know she never did anything deliberate to hurt anyone. She pointed out supplies were running out. The temperature was over 100 degrees. She said, what do you do when you have no way to treat people who are ill? There's no power. The ventilation has gone down. The machines that keep them alive are failing. She says these were patients who were critically ill, regardless of the storm. They had orders of do not resuscitate. In other words, if they died to allow them to die naturally and not to use heroic methods to resuscitate them. So it's just,
thanks for mentioning that with the Attorney General of Louisiana is bringing these charges. I think I might find out how to email this person and say, hey, how about the accomplices?
Yeah, there you go. And we're going to do a little more research into Charles Foti himself.
Okay, thanks.
Well,
thanks
a lot, Karen.
I'll watch your website.
Thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Good to hear from you. 1-866-440-8466. Tom in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, Tom.
Hey, I just wanted to elaborate a little bit on you talking about cons playing chess and the Dems playing checkers.
Right.
And you've been trying to expose this in your last three op-eds by using the words reclaiming the issues. Instead of war, use the word occupation. Instead of using the word immigration, use the word illegal employer. Instead of saying spying on Americans, use the word spying on Democrats. And you're trying to get those buzzwords out there, right?
I'm doing my best.
I know. Now, what's even deeper, Rove wants the liberals to say Bush administration bad. He also wants Republicans in Congress to say Bush is bad.
Oh, I've been saying this for 6 months, Tom. I've been saying that in this fall election, unless Bush can pull a rabbit out of the hat, he's going to be the essentially kind of the Republican antichrist. He's going to be the bad guy, and Republicans in Congress are going to run against him.
Yes.
They're doing that with his permission. They're, you know,
yes.
because Rove realizes that the only way he can stay out of jail and the only way Bush can avoid being impeached is if the Republicans hold the House and Senate.
Exactly.
Why do
the Democrats keep using the word Bush? They have to say everything in front of every word Republican-controlled Congress.
Right.
They
right.
are the enablers.
Oh, I know. It's, you know, you're not going to get any disagreement from me when you say that the Democrats are incompetent at messaging.
Saying the word Bush.
Yeah, okay. You
just
got
using
it.
The word Republican.
Yep, like the Republican Great Depression. There you
right.
go. Yep. Thank you, Tom.
Yep.
Good to hear from you. 1-866-440-8466. Tom in San Antonio, Texas. Hey, Tom.
Hi. No, it's Greg. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. Greg in San Antonio. You're right. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I just had a question. I have a corporation that's going to be coming down here, Lowe's Hardware Center, and our city council approved it 9-2 for them to have to come down here. But in order for them to come down, they need a 10-year tax deferment.
Right.
And I was just wondering if those taxes are, like, put on us as far as, you
yes.
know.
Yes. Well, somebody has to pay the bill. Somebody has to pay the bills of operating government. So if they're going to give Lowe's a big tax break, then they're going to have to raise your taxes. This is, interestingly, there's a piece in the Wall Street Journal that was, you know, in my stack of stuff to rant about. It's the headline, Energy Firms Keep Taxes at Bay. And this is about the most profitable, the second most profitable, actually, behind pharmaceuticals industry in the United States, the oil business. And, you know, quoting from the Wall Street Journal, major refinery companies are seeking and winning large local tax breaks with little political opposition. The various incentives combined with federal tax break package last year can offer refinery savings that reach hundreds of millions of dollars. Why? Because they go in and they play one community against the other. They say, well, we'll get some jobs if you allow us to site a refinery here, if you don't let us, but you got to give us tax breaks. And then say to another community, you know, they'll give us $100 million in tax breaks. If you give us 120, we'll put it over here. And then they go to the first community and say, they'll give us 120. Will you give us 150? This should be illegal. Companies have been doing this. Well, actually, the guy who started this was John Rockefeller when he started the whole charter mongering thing in the 1890s. And it should be illegal. It's just it's wrong, because what happens is you end up with, I mean, these incredibly profitable, you know, Chevron sought $22 million from the Mississippi legislature this year to support a road expansion. You know, it's just it's nuts. So, Greg, thanks for bringing it up and getting me all worked up. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Oh, my. Coming up in the next hour, we're going to have Jeffrey Feldman with us with Frame Shop is Open and talk about what are the frames of the day here. In the third hour of our program, Paul Sean Fitzgerald is going to be talking about killer cell phones. And Larry Scott from VAWatchdog.org will be with us. The latest shenanigans coming out of the Bush administration, how they're trying to stick it to our veterans. It's 57 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. Stick around. We'll be back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Jeffrey Feldman, one of the leading experts in the United States on political framing, is with us. He's the editor-in-chief over at frameshopisopen.com. Jeffrey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom.
Always great to have you on here. Caution. You have on your website this big caution sign, and it's like, look out, they're using the root cause frame.
Yeah, I mean, this the big topic, obviously, that everyone's discussing right now is what's going on between Lebanon and Israel in the Middle East. And in listening to all of the talking points that are coming out of the White House, in particular, the White House press briefings and some statements that the president has made just in the past 24 hours, I noticed that this phrase root cause is being repeated over and over again. And it's being used in a really peculiar way. It comes up in the context of discussing why the United States isn't pushing for a ceasefire more quickly, and people like Condoleezza Rice in particular are saying, look, we don't want a ceasefire that won't have in place, that won't allow us to get to the root causes of what's causing, what's going on there in the Middle East.
Now, the last time I heard this kind of language out of the administration was 2002, late 2002, as we were going into the November elections, and they were talking about Saddam Hussein being part of the root cause of 9/11.
Yeah, I mean, it's this broad way, this framing logic that the administration talks about as a way of explaining why it is that a preemptive strike type of approach to our foreign policy is necessary, rather than what they do is they identify what they believe to be a danger, and then they define this danger using this metaphor of weeds, in which the logic is you go in and you can't just clip the weed off at the top, but you need to go in with a giant shovel, in this case, you know, the shock and awe campaigns, and get at those root causes. And then And this is kind of the magic leap in their arguments. Then once you get at that root cause, then the problems will go away. Of course, what we've seen over the past few years is that it doesn't really work out that way, because when you go at this, at the root causes, if that's the logic that you take, then you end up initially having a lot of explosions and a lot of what appears to be military success, but then over time that success erodes and turns into resistance, and we get something that looks like what you have in Iraq, or what you have in the case of the Israeli use of a similar philosophy, what you have in the West Bank.
And yet there's tremendous power in this frame, because there's reality to it. I mean, why don't we just flip this thing around and say, yeah, we need to deal with the root cause of the problem of, for example, Hezbollah and Hamas. And the way, and what's bringing this problem about is the fact that these two institutions have survived the transition, or the beginning of the transition, from being essentially resistance fighters slash terrorists to being political players. You know, Hamas actually getting elected to run the government in the Palestinian territories, and Hezbollah is winning almost 20 seats in the parliament in Lebanon, simply because they are dealing with the root cause problem, which is they're running schools and they're running hospitals. The root cause is poverty and lack of development in the area. I mean, we should be promoting democracy by trying to strengthen these people, you know, the middle class and the bottom rung economically in these nations, rather than talking about the root cause is philosophy. It ain't philosophy.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. I mean, another point to add to that is something that I just heard in an interview between John Edwards and former President Jimmy Carter, in which Carter said, look, you know, one of the problems that we have in our diplomacy right now is that if anybody in the world disagrees with the Bush administration, and the Bush administration says, fine, we will not talk to you ever again. And right. So we have a diplomacy based on shunning people who disagree with us.
Right, which is what Bush does, by the way, with his own advisors and his own cabinet.
Exactly. And so, you know, part of the solution to these problems, in addition to investing in, you know, at the bottom of the economic ladder in these countries that have these particular problems, the other solution is to start rebuilding coalitions, to see these types of flare-ups as being solved by bringing together a group of nations with like interests, standing united together, and then confronting these problems together. Historically, right. When we do this, it seems to lead to success. Bosnia, the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait, and when we go it alone with these root cause philosophy, it leads to slowly deteriorating failure in our policy.
At least as long as they're mischaracterizing the root cause.
Exactly.
So maybe we should just take their meme and flip it around and say, yeah, one of the root causes is the fact that people aren't talking to each other. And by the way, the Bush administration is making that worse.
Yeah, I mean, always flipping language, the conservative language on its head is a fantastic way to take control of the debate.
Yeah, another big one here today, the snowflake babies. This we had Sam Brown back yesterday in the United States House of Representatives, as I recall, up there with a kid who was, you know, conceived in vitro and saying, ah, here, look at this. She would have gone down the drain and, you know, or would have been made into stem cell research to cure cancer or something, and we can't have that. Incredible.
It is incredible. This snowflake babies phrase is something that's being really, it's being pushed very, very hard by the conservatives in the stem cell debate. And the logic is that you have a couple that wants to get pregnant, and so you go through the in vitro fertilization process, which produces an excess number of embryos, some of which go into a cryogenic freezing. I'm not exactly sure how it works. I'm not a scientist. But then you have this organization called the Nightlight Christian Adoption Service, which develops this concept, and they've even trademarked the idea that you adopt these snowflake babies. And it's really fascinating. I encourage people to go to this website, which is linked off of Frameshop is open, and you can see that they use this language of calling these embryos sitting in these frozen chambers pre-born children, and you adopt the pre-born child, and then they characterize the mother as simply completing the process of birth, of birthing her adopted child. And it's a really troublesome way of framing the debate, and yet I believe that it's going to be extremely powerful in the next week as the president vetoes the stem cell bill, which was passed by the Congress, and the question of why it is that stem cell research is bad in the conservative worldview explodes across the big media. I think that stem cell babies are going to become the celebrities of this week in the news.
Or snowflake babies, yeah. What they've done is they've leapfrogged over the debate that we had in the 1970s, and we did have this debate very much in the 1960s and 70s about when does life begin. And, you know, and there was this, and the Supreme Court ultimately in 1973 in Roe v. Wade essentially said life begins at the point at which a fetus is viable. It can live outside the womb. And conservatives, not conservatives, religious zealots of a couple of particular stripes have been saying all along that life begins either at the moment of intercourse, because they don't want Plan B to be available, which isn't an abortifacient, it's simply a birth control pill post-intercourse. Either life begins at the moment of intercourse, or at the very least, life begins at the moment that the sperm fertilizes the egg.
Yeah, or the moment of cell division is the way it was explained to me. And so you end up with this peculiar status of what we would consider to be a potential, an embryo that has the potential, once placed into a woman's body, to become a viable fetus and then potentially to come to term and be born as a full child. Once it's a part of the woman's body, that gets talked about as some type of individual already in the test tube that's undergoing a heroic struggle to find a way to be born, despite all of the threats that are coming at it from liberals in this country who want to either throw it away or give it to scientists to perform what are characterized as murderous operations, when in fact what's going on in stem cell research is a remarkable attempt to do something incredibly American, which is to find cures for seemingly incurable diseases, which is a really, really important part of the American character, this belief that we have, that we can accomplish these seemingly impossible goals through science.
Yeah. We're talking with Jeffrey Feldman, the editor of FrameShopIsOpen.com, editor-in-chief there. Finally, Jeffrey, you tip your hat to the Democrats in the House of Representatives today.
I tip my hat. You know, today, most Americans would be surprised to know that amidst all that's going on in the world, the Republicans are leading a debate this morning about protecting the Pledge of Allegiance from what they believe as an assault from an activist judiciary, this ridiculous, ridiculous debate. And rather than getting drawn into this, the Democrats led with a unified voice and reframed all of this issue, this entire issue, to make it a debate about the minimum wage. It was very, very impressive. And in particular, a representative from Florida, Hastings, was incredibly strong at saying, look, the Republicans are wasting our time. We should not be discussing the Pledge of Allegiance, but we should be talking about the fact that if you work full-time on minimum wage in this country, you are still below the poverty line. And Nancy Pelosi really hammered this point hard. They were excellent speakers today, and I was very proud to be a Democrat.
Yeah, indeed. And in fact, the minimum wage, interesting, you know, the history of the minimum wage, that back when it was first proposed, you know, during the Eisenhower administration, it was established as a function of, or it was set as a function of the prevailing wage.
Exactly.
We should go back to it being a percentage of the prevailing wage. Anyhow, Jeffrey Feldman, the editor-in-chief of FrameShopIsOpen.com. Coming up, an update from the belly of the beast of the Talk Radio News Service. Thanks, Jeffrey, for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Great talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman Radio Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Indeed, it's a heat wave all across the United States of America. I'll tell you, global warming is apparently here. And I shouldn't be chuckling about it. Glaciers on Mount Hood, which feeds the river that I live on, literally on, we live in a house that floats on the river, those glaciers are melting. They're going away, which is the moderating influence on the river. So now we're more subject to the possibility of floods and low water levels, and it's getting kind of spooky out there, I'll tell you. Greg Gorman is with us with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com, the website. Hey, good morning, Greg, or good afternoon.
Well, good morning. It's actually morning for me, Tom. I'm actually in almost your neck of the woods. I'm in San Francisco, California, so I'm living the West Coast life today.
Well, welcome to the West Coast.
Well,
get up to Portland. Come visit us.
That's right. You know, I'm here for the American Legislative Exchange Council's annual conference. And the interesting thing is that tomorrow night, really, the Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez is going to be here speaking to these people. And I'm very interested because, as you probably know, on the cover of USA Today and probably lots of other newspapers, there's a story that yesterday Gonzalez actually spoke to Congress and said that President George W. Bush blocked the investigation of the warrantless surveillance program. So I'm going to be very interested to see what he has to say here in San Francisco tomorrow.
In fact, here's Gonzalez about that.
Did the president make the decision not to clear OPR?
As with all decisions that are non-operational in terms of who has access to the program, the president of the United States makes the decision.
So George Bush decided that the executive branch, which he's the head of, would not grant security clearance to the investigators within the executive branch, which he's the head of, to investigate whether the executive branch, which he's the head of, had committed crimes against the American people and broken the law of the United States that had been passed by the congressional branch, which he's not part of, and certified by the judicial branch, which he has disdain for.
Well, he is the decider, Tom. Let's not forget.
That's right.
He's the decider. He gets
Thanks
to
for
decide.
Reminding me, Greg. Yeah.
I thought you'd like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And, of course, even though that I'm in San Francisco, California, everyone here is talking about the stem cell debate and the veto, his first veto, and this ALEC convention. They're very conservative, but they're very interested in how state legislatures and state governments can help people in their own states on certain issues. And even though they won't talk about stem cell as part of the conference, it's on everyone's minds here. Whether you're for it or you're against it, it's the president saying, look, I'm going to veto this bill. I'm not for it. I'm for human life, even though it looks like he's not, because he's taking, federal dollars away from people with Alzheimer's and things where they can actually be saved as opposed to frozen embryos that are going to be destroyed anyway.
Right. And there were actually three votes on the stem cell issue. Two
right,
of them
right.
were 100-0. They were basically kind of peripheral side issue votes. But I suspect in some districts, those who voted against stem cell research are going to be pointing to those two yes votes and saying, see, I voted for this.
That's absolutely what's going to happen. And that's going to happen, and it's going to happen sooner rather than later because the midterms are so close now, what, about 3 months away?
Yeah, yeah. So this is all turning political. And in those areas where the stem cell debate plays against Bush, then you'll find Republicans who are going to run against him. They're going to say, I tried to stand up to the president. And in those areas, hyper-conservative areas where the religious Reich rules, they'll say, I stood with the president to stop the killing of these single-cell organisms.
Absolutely. Oh, I can hear it now.
Yeah, yeah, it's remarkable. Now, Helen Thomas, here's an interaction with Tony Snow and Helen Thomas in the White House this morning.
Well, thank you for the Hezbollah view.
Why did we veto a ceasefire?
We didn't veto a ceasefire.
Yes, we did.
No, we didn't. There was no ceasefire. I'm sorry.
A resolution?
No.
At the UN?
No, the UN, no.
There was no veto at the UN.
No, there hasn't been a resolution at the VN, UN, whatever it is. I've been to,
Uh-oh.
There hasn't been... I've been at GOs in Germany too long. There's been no resolution at the UN.
Yeah, so here's Tony Snow claiming that there was no resolution when, in fact, we did veto a resolution. What's the deal? And not only that, talking...
resolution, and he calls it the VN. What is that about? Look, I've been saying for a while, I like Tony Snow as a person. I think he's a great performer, but he's got loose lips, and loose lips sink ships, as we all know. He's going to say something that's going to get him and his boss in trouble. And Helen Thomas is just the person to bring it out of him, that's for sure.
Yeah. Well, this has been such a Teflon presidency. I mean, so many crimes have been committed. So many things have been just laid bare. And they just, the news cycle just moves on. Or Rove pulls another, hey, we caught a terrorist 6 months ago, but we're going to tell you about it right now, out of the bag. This one's going to slide by, too, isn't it?
Well, it seems like it's going to. And, I've heard Ellen Ratner say this, too, how people used to call, Bill Clinton, the Teflon president, everything's,
And Reagan, actually. He's the guy that they first applied it to.
Right. You know what? It seems like it's going to be the same thing for Bush. He's getting away with so many things. I mean, his attorney general went before Congress and said that he blocked an investigation using his power. What's going to happen? He's the attorney general. And it seems like even though it's on the front page of the paper today, it's not going to go anywhere.
Yeah, I had a caller earlier who was like, why aren't people out in the streets on this? And I'm
right.
like, yeah, why?
Absolutely.
I mean, this is incredible. The attorney general admitting that the president blocked an investigation into whether or not he broke the law? What?
Exactly. In front of Congress, no doubt. In front of Congress. It's not like, what he...
Why are the Democrats not calling press conferences and screaming about this?
Right.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's the answer to the question.
Exactly. Right. Why are they not? I'm with
you. There you go. Greg Gorman with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Greg, have a great time in San Francisco.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
Beautiful city. Great. And thank you for being on the program. 27 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman Radio Program.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Oh, the fishes will laugh as they swim out of the path, and the seagulls, they'll be smiling, and the rocks on the sand will proudly stand the hour that the ship comes in. And the words that are used for to get the ship confused will not be understood as the spoken. For the chains of the sea will have busted in the night and be buried on the bottom of the ocean.
And welcome back to the place where we run rings around the right wing. 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, 52 weeks a year. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, toll-free across the United States. If you want to drop into our live chat room, you can go to tomhartman.com and click live chat. It'll get you in there. Bill Kristol on Fox News, the uber neocon, arguably his father, one of the founders of the whole neocon movement, uber neocon spokesman, talking on Fox News about Iran. Right, Iran.
So the Iranian people dislike their regime. I think they would be the right use of targeted military force, but especially if political pressure before we use military force could cause them to reconsider whether they really want to have this regime in power. There are even moderates. They're not wonderful people, but people in the government itself who probably are nervous about Ahmadinejad's recklessness.
Yeah, except that we have this, I think, fairly Looney Tunes guy who's the president of Iran because the people of Iran elected him. And why did they elect him? Because we've been acting absolutely, totally nuts in the region. We have been, you know, blundering around, barging into Iraq and Iran, two of the axis of evil nations. Well, let's invade one of them. Now, should we invade the other? Come on, the Iranians are not stupid. They can get American news on their they see these talking heads on Fox News and in the press. By the way, the minimum wage, and thanks to Mike who sent this to me in email, the minimum wage in 1957 under Eisenhower, he says, was set to 40% of the median household income. At that level, a couple working both working minimum wage jobs would make 80% of the average family in the U.S. That was considered reasonable and fair. He said. That would currently correspond to a little over $11 an hour. Actually, I do the math on this, and I think the median household income in the United States is around $40,000, so that would put it around $8 an hour. But in any case, says in other words, a couple starting out could get to middle class and put some money aside in case they decided to become a one-income family and raise children. He says, we're not being radical. We just want to return to that period. The Republicans have such misty-eyed nostalgia for the Eisenhower era. Makes sense to me. 1-866-440-8466. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary.
Hi, Tom.
What's up?
Good morning. I want to ask you a question, but first, before I do that, only one question. Thanks for mentioning Ed Muskie, my hero, my absolute hero, the godfather of all our water and pollution control laws.
Yeah, he was a good man, and he was an avid environmentalist.
The best. The question I have for you, I was just precluded by just saying God gave us, including myself, everybody obviously, God gave us a brain to think, not to feel. And this thing that this
What if we're supposed to do both?
Well, we're supposed to feel, but this is specifically about this, of anybody to throw out this, the Republicans, Karl Rove I'm talking about. He's throwing this poll out. And this is what they're running on also, that the American people feel more comfortable with George Bush in there for protecting America than the Democrats.
This is actually a Gallup poll. I have the thing in front of me right here. Rove might be citing it, but this is a Gallup poll. It was done June 26th through 29, and they asked Republicans and Democrats, self-identified, who their who their choice was. And among Republicans, who would they want for to be running for president? Rudy Giuliani got 73%, yes, acceptable. 25%, no, not acceptable. No opinion, 2%. Condi Rice, 68%. John McCain, 55%. That's everybody who's above 50%. And then next after that was the Newt Gingrich at 45%. And Jeb Bush at 44%. So, you know, it really looks like Giuliani or Condi Rice or John McCain on the Republican side. On the Democratic side, it's interesting. The top person is John Edwards. And the media is not talking about John Edwards. He got 71% of the vote as acceptable. And only 25% not acceptable, whereas Hillary Rodham Clinton got 29% not acceptable and 69% acceptable. So John Edwards beat Hillary Clinton both on being acceptable and as a lower not acceptable rating. And yet the media is constantly talking about nothing but Hillary Clinton. Why? Because in my opinion, they want Hillary Clinton to run in 2008.
Well, the next question is, thank you for accepting my call, Tom. Feeling a little depressed about the America, in the sense that you're doing a fantastic job. It's going to take us going to change it at the ballot, but to cut through this nonsense. What has happened to America?
Well, what's happened is that we've been taken over by neocon ideologues, by right-wing ideologues. I agree. Yeah, and these guys really, and thank you, Gary, for the call. These guys really and truly believe, at least the ideological base of them, really and truly believe that what they're doing is the right thing. And that's what's so dangerous, is when you get people who are absolute true believers. I mean, you know, look at the Bolshevik Revolution. Look at the American Revolution. And when you get people who are really true believers in political reform and a new system, whether they're right or wrong, I would say the American Revolution was right and the Bolshevik Revolution, it was partly right, partly wrong. But in any case, you get people who really believe in something, they're a force to be reckoned with. And the problem is you've got the true believers, we need to come up with a new word for it. The Christian cultists, for lack of a better phrase, who they call themselves the pro-life movement, who are opposed to stem cell research and all this stuff. You've got those true believers and the true believers who think that Christianity is under assault in the United States and that Islam is evil. I mean, that whole kind of collection, the American Christian theocrats, you have those true believers. Then you have the economic true believers, the libertarians, the objectivists, the Ayn Rand folks, the Cato folks, the Heritage Foundation folks. And they're both being played for suckers by the very wealthy elite in the Republican Party and on the right, who are funding these think tanks and funding these programs and using them to get out the base. Because you know that they're being played for suckers, because what happens when Republicans get into power? They do things that, you know, they don't outlaw abortion. They don't, merge the church and state. Well, actually, they're moving us in that direction. But mostly what they do is economic stuff. You know, the bankruptcy bill, NAFTA, CAFTA. They do things that help the very wealthy get even wealthier and reduce taxes on the rich and shift the responsibility for paying for today's commons, today's expenses of operating government, today's needs, shift that onto the backs of our children and our grandchildren. That's what they do. And it's a very cynical thing. And what we have to do, Gary, is we have to expose that, and we have to move forward. We get out there and get active, expose it, and bring it into the ballot box and bring it into the voting booth. And it has to happen. And I think it is happening, frankly. I'm frankly very encouraged by it. I see a lot of Americans waking up. Yesterday, by the way, the primaries in Georgia, a news release that we got, I got this via Mark Crispin Miller. I believe it's from Cynthia McKinney's office, who's been on this program before. Cynthia McKinney, in fact, she got thrown off the floor of the House of Representatives for reading out loud an article that I had written for commondreams.org. God bless her. Anyhow, here's the news release. After 1 hour of voting, so presumably this was yesterday morning, after 1 hour of voting, the McKinney campaign has received numerous calls that the voting machines are malfunctioning. Now, keep in mind, Georgia was the first state in the union in the 2002 election to use entirely touchscreen machines with no paper trail whatsoever. They also had polls both before and after the election of 2002 showing that Max Cleland won the election by about 5 points. And according to these paperless touchscreen voting machines, Saxby Chambliss, the Republican who had been a draft dodger during Vietnam, Max Cleland lost three limbs in Vietnam. The draft dodger who ran on being more patriotic than the war hero, according to all the polls, 5 points behind in the polls, both before and after the election, won by 5 points, according to the voting machines. So anyhow, after 1 hour of voting yesterday in Georgia, the McKinney campaign has received numerous calls that the voting machines are malfunctioning. Voters casting votes for McKinney are reportedly having their votes switched by the machines for Hank Johnson. This is not a new problem with Diebold machines. Lawyers for the campaign have been alerted and said that if this situation is not corrected, Cynthia McKinney for Congress will be forced to take additional measures. So we're gonna track that thing down. David's going to be contacting Cynthia McKinney's office and just any further word on this? You know, what's the deal? What's going on here? 1-866-440-8466. Sean in Indianapolis, Indiana. Hey, Sean, we just have a minute before I have to take a break.
Hey,
is it a quickie?
Hey, Tom, I wanted to bring up that there's a difference between euthanasia and being a DNR. You don't have to justify what the doctors and nurses did in New Orleans to disagree with the pro-lifers. The pro-lifers, I think, are exploiting this unfortunate incident to further their cause.
Yeah, it certainly seems like it to me, and I'm expecting that probably the arrest of this doctor and these two nurses is going to be big news on the right-wing talking shows and circuits and whatnot. Although, who knows? I mean, maybe they got so badly burned by Terry Schiavo that they don't want to go there again.
But you know, when the electricity goes out and you're a DNR, you don't need to, and people are on a vent,
yeah,
then you don't need to, you don't need to give people lethal injections.
Right. It's just a question of,
they're not gonna, you know.
Right. It's just a question of whether the doctors were going to allow these people to die in excruciating pain or relieve
it's
them of that pain by,
but excruciating.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Sean. Right. Appreciate it. 45 minutes past the hour at the Tom Hartman Project. I understand they were all on morphine, so I'm assuming there was some pain. We'll be right back.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
I stoke the mighty furnaces and roll the flaming steel. I operated oil rigs and wells. And when the country needed them, I built the planes and tanks to send the tyrants down to fry in hell. I'm the man that built the bridges. I'm the man that laid the track. I'm the man that built this country with my shoulders and my back. I'm the man that built the power dams and oiled all the cars. And I laid down the cornerstone for this great land of ours.
And welcome back to the radio support group of, by, and for We the People, the Tom Hartman radio program. Just to wrap up this poll, the Democratic poll, this is the most recent Gallup poll. John Edwards, number one, is the Democratic candidate. 71% acceptable, only 25% not acceptable. What's interesting, it goes down from there. He was at 71%, Hillary Clinton at 69%, Al Gore at 68%, John Kerry at 59%. So those are the four that were above 50%. That's pretty good. But you look at the not acceptables, 40% of Democrats said that John Kerry was not acceptable, compared to 25% for John Edwards. 31% said Al Gore was not acceptable. 29% said Hillary Clinton is not acceptable, compared to 25% for John Edwards. And it continues, it goes up. Wesley Clark, 49% not acceptable, 42% acceptable. Howard Dean, 54% not acceptable, 40% acceptable. So it's look at this, and the only person who had, there were only two candidates who were below 30% not acceptable, and that was Hillary Clinton at 29% and John Edwards at 25%. This is measuring the negatives. And they were also the top two candidates in terms of acceptable, which I guess would make sense, 71% to 69%, 71% for John Edwards, 69% for Hillary Rodham Clinton. So it's going to be interesting to see how this thing shakes out. In addition to the four leading candidates, more Democrats said that they would find Joe Biden to be acceptable and unacceptable. Evenly divided on Governor Bill Richardson, Tom Vilsack, Dennis Kucinich, they're all, you know, 19, 20, 21%. Mark Warner, 29%. Russ Feingold, 29%. Acceptable, 41%. Unacceptable. It's fascinating. It's a fascinating study. And it's 2 years away. 2 years from now. In the meantime, think before you enjoy it, writes Michael McCarthy and Steve Connor in The Independent in the United Kingdom. This is the the British newspaper. The near record temperatures expected today. See, they're gonna hit 100 degrees today in Great Britain, in England, and in southern England. And this is the second time in the history of Great Britain that it's hit 100 degrees Fahrenheit. And it's also the second time in 3 years. And they note this, researchers said the unusual heat was entirely consistent with predictions of climate change caused by rising emissions of greenhouse gases such as carbon dioxide from power stations, motor transport, and increasingly aircraft. Temperatures are expected to peak today, et cetera, et cetera. And we're seeing the same thing across the United States. We're seeing, you know, warming all across the United States. But while the British media, here's the headline, temperature set to 100 to hit 100 degrees and global warming is to blame. That's the headline in the newspaper in Great Britain. You expect to see any similar headlines in the United States? Somehow, I doubt it. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Dolores and Monahague, pronounce that for me, Dolores, would you please?
Monongahela.
Monongahela. That's great. I love that word. it's the name of your town in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, well, first of all, I love your show. I listen to you most every day.
Well, thank you. And WPTT, I'm assuming and hoping.
I have a thought, and maybe way off base, but I'm calling to get your opinion because you're so knowledgeable. But I was thinking, you know how bad Bush wanted to go to Iran. There's no two ways about that, start trouble with them. Well, I was thinking, is he using Israel to start this up, and then he had already warned Iran and Syria not to interfere with his bombing, Israel's bombing there now. Well, if Israel got involved with Iran, then Bush would get his way anyhow because he'd say, oh, we have to go in and help out Israel, and we have to bomb Iran.
Yeah,
now, my way off base, but I don't trust this administration at all.
Well, this is what Seymour Hersh was talking about 6 months ago. He said, this is what's coming down the road. The U.S. and Israel are going to get together and bomb the nuclear facilities in Iran.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, whether you think it's a good idea or not, he was just like, this is what they're planning. They've already got the plans in place there at the Pentagon.
So I'm not way off base.
So, no, I don't think you're way off base.
Well, I thank you so much because you're so knowledgeable.
Well, I'm not an expert on everything, Dolores, but I have an opinion.
I knew a tenth of what you know.
Well, bless you. Thanks for the call and thanks for listening.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Yeah, and I appreciate the call. There's an awful lot of interesting stuff going on out there. It's really, really, frankly, I think a great time to be alive. The debt, I want to... I'm not sure if we'll have enough time today to really dig into this thing. We hopefully will soon. But Joey in the Philippines. Hey, Joey, we have a half a minute left. You wanted to make a quick comment? I know it's a long-distance call for you.
Thank you for receiving my call. I'm here in the Philippines on the boat, and I'm hearing you on Marine Radio.
Uh-huh. Great.
Now, I'm going back to the United States because, as you said, I'm going to vote this coming elections. The only thing that will prove to the Republicans that we got a sleeper cell of the Democratic Party, and what we do is to defeat congressmen who are lame ducks of the president now in America.
Yeah, you're talking about the DLC Democrats, Democrats who are really secretly Republicans.
Yeah, because it's not only the terrorists has these sleeper cells down there, but we get the Democrat sleeper cells that we're going to vote. All Democrat congressmen all over America, we're going to have the canvas on this, and we have lots of American citizens in the Philippines going back to America during election time.
Interesting. So there's a lot of Filipinos who are American citizens who are coming back here just to vote, like you.
Yes.
Interesting, Joey. Well, congratulations for coming back to vote, and thanks for being an American citizen, and thanks for the call from the Philippines. I appreciate it. I'm sorry we're out of time here at the top of the hour, but interesting concept you put forward. It's 57 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Coming up on Everything You Know Is Wrong, Paul Sean Fitzgerald, the founder of the Research Center for Wireless Technology, is going to be telling us about killer cell phones. Stick around.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to our program, the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination, or at least a clean election. In just a moment, we're going to talk to Paul Sean Fitzgerald about the potential danger of cell phones. First, Caroline in Tempe, Arizona, wanted to make a plug about an upcoming demonstration. Activist events were always up for. Hey, Caroline.
Hi there, Tom. I sure do appreciate you taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, here in Phoenix, Arizona, Women in Black and Code Pink and other members of the peace community, we've called a silent vigil for peace in the Middle East. We don't care who started it. We just want the killing of innocent civilians to stop. And I deplore the fact that Bush has not backed, called for a ceasefire.
Yeah, in fact, we had a jolly good fellow alert here at the beginning of the program for Dennis Kucinich, who's introduced a resolution into the House calling just for that, a ceasefire and diplomacy. Yeah. Yeah, so Caroline, tomorrow, when and where is the demonstration?
It's going to be Friday. July 21st from 5 to 6 p.m. in Phoenix. It'll be on the northeast corner of McDowell and Central.
Great.
And we're asking people to just bring a peaceful heart and signs that reflect it. We don't take sides. We need to stop the killing of innocent civilians. This is a war crime.
Well said. Caroline, thank you.
Yep,
thank you very much for the call.
Thanks,
I appreciate
Tom.
It. Good luck.
Bye-bye.
And Paul Sean Fitzgerald now with us. He's with emfnews.org or danger911.com. I think they both take you to the same place, don't they, Paul?
They do.
Welcome to the program. You're all about how cell phones are basically frying our brains and nuking us. The cell phone industry would portray this as kind of fringe stuff.
Well, the way you just worded it there in the beginning, I saw an experiment on the Internet. I don't know how accurate this is, but I'm going to have to go out there and verify it by testing myself. But they took an egg, and with the egg, what they did is they put two cell phones in cigarette cartons, ironically, they put the egg in a porcelain cup, two eggs against it. They called each cell phone, and they played a radio so that the cell phones would keep communicating back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
Within 15 minutes, the eggshell got hot. Within 30 minutes, it got very, very hot. Within 45 minutes, the white part was cooked within the egg. Within 65 minutes, the egg was fully hard-boiled and done. So frying your brain, if that experiment is accurate, which I can't wait to verify this, is scary to say the least.
Well, let's talk about the science that actually has been done. I understand that the cell phone industry itself spent several million dollars to do a study on the safety of cell phones, and then they decided that they didn't want us to know about it.
Well, that's a great. In 1993, there were about 15 million cell phone users, and Larry King got a hold of a man named Dave Reynard, who his wife had died of a tumor that was the same size and shape as her cell phone antenna. This alarmed the industry. What they did is they hired Dr. George Carlo, a public health scientist. They put together $28 million, a six-year study, highest quality control as you could imagine. After no problem for the first few years, the end of the study found non-thermal effects, non-heating cellular effects. What those studies showed was blood-brain breachage opening, double-strand DNA breakage, micronuclei formation. In short, what that means, those are all very strong signs of cancer formation within the body.
Well, these are things that could lead to cancer. They're signs of radiation exposure of some sort.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So what are the safest cell phones available on the market? I mean, is there a difference, for example, between clamshell ones that seem to sort of protect you from the antenna and those that are just the little square boxes with the antenna sticking out the top?
Well, the problem with all the studies, they're all based on the SAR, the specific absorption ratio, which is the thermal effect, the heating effect. And when none of the studies are based on the non-thermal, non-heating effect that I was just speaking about throughout the world, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
They've used plastic mannequin heads to figure out the thermal effects, which is a very inaccurate way to prove the safety that we base all our standards on. So when I'm saying this isn't a good, accurate portrayal, is because of cellular effects. For example, the blood-brain barrier opening, that's our protective mechanism for our brain to keep it safe. And that's what happens with only 2 minutes on a cell phone. Leif Salford at the Lund University in Sweden showed 1/200th of a milliwatt is all it takes to open up the blood-brain barrier.
But the blood-brain barrier is keeping spinal fluid in and around the brain and blood outside that. If that were to open, you'd have a meltdown of a biological system. And this doesn't make sense to me because you'd have spinal fluid leaking out into the bloodstream or blood leaking into the brain. You'd have a stroke.
Not necessarily a meltdown.
The results would be pretty profound pretty rapidly.
Well, with it being a semi-permeable membrane, and it, because my understanding more is that it's you're going to have a messy cup of soup. You're going to have free radical damage. It's keeping our blood.
So what you're suggesting is that the membrane isn't actually being breached. It's becoming more permeable.
Well, his science showed it actually opens it. It showed 2 minutes on the cell phone opens up the blood-brain barrier for up to an hour.
Opens how much of it to what?
Well, that science, that's a great question. I don't have the answer to that one.
Yeah.
That's something I'm making note of to
go into. So what about sticking a headset into your phone and holding the phone in your hand, you know, a foot away from your body and talking on the headset instead?
Well, we thought that was a very safe way to go. But what happens with the headset is the electromagnetic fields that travel right up the wire directly into your ear. And they can also attract ambient radiation to the headset. So
the headset becomes functionally part of the antenna of the phone.
Exactly.
Hmm.
So the only thing I found very, very safe at this point in time is an air tube headset, where the last 4 or 5 inches of the headset are an air tube, stethoscope-type tube.
Right.
And sound waves go through it instead of electrical waves.
Right. Now, what about Bluetooth technology?
Well, that's back to Leif Salford and his research on the blood-brain barrier. If that's all accurate and 1/200th of a milliwatt will open up the blood-brain barrier, then you're dealing with the Bluetooth, which is 1/10th of a watt. So you're going to have that initial problem. The Bluetooth, and let's take, for example, here, the Bluetooth is just a lot of people think just because they're not talking on their cell phone, It's fine. It's not checking into the cell tower. But what happens is every minute or so, your cell phone checks into the cell tower, and the Bluetooth checks into your cell phone because that's its cell tower.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not any safer.
Yeah. Now, I noticed that on danger911.com, your website, you're selling these Q-Links and these EFM chips. I have some background in electrical engineering. I'm not putting myself out here as a PhD or anything, but I was once licensed by the FCC as an electrical engineer. I'm an old ham radio operator. I studied it in college, electrical engineering. And, you know, I have seen these. They don't make any sense to me. Tell me how this stuff works. A copper coil here, your Q-Link, or the EFF chip that you're claiming is this magical proprietary technology. How does it work?
Well, there are different technologies. The EMF chip, when astronauts go into space, they are subjected to high electromagnetic fields. They've discovered a technology that actually neutralizes the EMF fields they're exposed to. It's a quantum physics type technology that is supposed to transfer the wave. See, humans, the one thing that in nature, the EMF wave is not a sinuous wave that keeps going at the same volume. It's different. It's erratic. It's an erratic frequency. See, in nature, man-made frequencies are very continuous. And so what this does is it changes the wave to make it safer, or gives it an uneven, more of a natural.
That doesn't make any sense to me. And the way that astronauts protect themselves from radiation is by being in a metal box, basically.
Well, they used to be in the metal box in the suit and come back, and they would not recover as quickly. See, the only way to measure these devices is take an oscilloscope to them. When you take an oscilloscope, you can see how the wave changes.
Yeah.
And that's the only real way to, because I know where you're coming from, because I went to the New Jersey Institute of Technology. And
so you're saying by changing the consistency of the frequency of the radiation, you're rendering it less destructive?
Less harmful to the body. They've shown There's been research. There's one movie out there that shows you when you don't have the continuous sinuous wave going, the brain does not act the same way as when it's continuous and man-made.
Interesting. Very interesting. Okay, Paul Fitzgerald, danger911.com. Thanks for being with us, Paul. Appreciate it. Is it possible?
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Maybe, or maybe not. Oh, we'll find out. 16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
While you're strolling down the fairway, showing no remorse, flowing from the poisons they've sprayed on your golf course. While you're busy sinking birdies and keeping your scorecard, the devil's been busy in your backyard.
All right, welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Let's see. Da 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 da. There you go. Hey, Larry.
Hi, Tom. And I'm not up on my code. I didn't quite catch all of that.
Well, I thought that was your call. W-A-1-V-E-T. Da 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 da. No. Yeah. Da 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 da. Right.
That, there you go. W-A-1-V-E-T, the old ham operator here, too.
Yep. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So, that's my call. Anyway, welcome to the program. We were just talking to a guy who's selling some kind of strange cell phone stuff, and it was our, you know, Everything You Know Is Wrong segment where we kind of push the edge of, you know, could this be true, or is this really, you know,
yes,
out there?
I heard him.
Yeah, and I'm increasingly thinking it's in outer space. But in any case, it's good to have another ham radio operator on the program. Larry, of course, is the founder and editor of VAWatchdog.org, the premier site for veterans to figure out what's going on with the VA. They watch the VA because somebody's got to, and doing a fine job of it. Larry, the VA's number one attorney has resigned. What's the significance of Tim McClain leaving?
Tim McClain is kind of a fall guy here. Tim McClain, who is the general counsel for the VA, the top attorney and a political appointee, it was announced this morning that he is resigning to go to an unspecified job in the private sector. What this really means is he was forced out. Tim McClain has fought for the last year a centralization of information technology in the VA, and what the Congress has been pushing is what they call a strong chief information officer, a strong CIO, one person who would have control of everything in information inside the VA. What this would be a $2+ billion budget, hiring and firing of all personnel, and one person controlling all hardware and all software. This was fought by McClain, not because he was against it, because he's their general counsel. And he said, there's nothing in the statutes, there's nothing in the law that allows this one person to have this amount of control. These functions have to be departmentalized and segments
sure,
for the different areas of the VA. And what they've done now is basically they're saying, well, you really stood in our way, and this was part of the data theft debacle. You're out of here.
So Jim Nicholson, the political appointee, the Bush administration head of the VA, his main claim to fame is that he's an incredibly wealthy Republican. He's pushing this down, this idea of let's centralize everything, let's create a Politburo here.
Pretty much, yes, and this has come basically from the House Committee on Veterans Affairs, the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs, and
Stephen Boyer and Larry Craig.
Right, and Boyer and Craig, and it's come up. It has come up through the party ranks that this is what they want. They had hired a chief information officer who had been a big Dell computer salesman. And he just said, well, no, if you're not going to give me the whole bottle of wax, I'm out of here. He resigned, and they're moving in another person. What you're going to see is you're going to see the privatizing of VA software, which is now open source software, and you're going to see a lot of money being made on the privatization of that software, and also some incredibly large hardware contracts going out to friends of the correct political party.
Gee, what a surprise.
And surprise, surprise.
I'm just amazed that the Republican Party would use our veterans to make some money.
I really can't figure that out. And we should also say about the data theft debacle, now the White House yesterday, you know, the VA had offered free credit monitoring?
Yeah.
OMB, Office of Management Budget, came out yesterday. The White House said, no, no way. There's going to be no free credit monitoring. We're withdrawing our request for $160 million.
Well, they're saying that they're withdrawing the request because they got the data back.
But, well, that's the whole problem. They really don't have the data back. And what they have is they have a hard drive with the data on it. And what we found out, the VA's Inspector General issued a report last week. The data, the veterans' data that was stolen, was not on the laptop. It was on an external hard drive. That hard drive simply had a USB plug on it. It was not password protected. It was not encrypted in any way. And it was not, as we were originally told, put in what is called SAS data sets. These are data sets that make it extremely hard to access and manipulate the data.
Right.
It was plain and simply open data that anybody could have grabbed. The FBI says we're reasonably sure that nobody accessed this. And again, anybody who knows anything about computers saying, wait a minute, that's not true.
Yeah.
they have no way of knowing who accessed what. But whether or not, don't worry, there's no problem. It's all gone away.
As soon as it looked like it might cost $160 million, the Bush administration said, don't worry, no problem.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah. And it was just that simple. And they have now declined. And here's the real problem. We have three suits going forward seeking class action status because veterans have spent money on this. Secretary Nicholson told veterans, watch your credit, take advantage of your free credit reports. What about veterans? And there were many of them who had already had their free credit reports, Tom, so they paid for this service. Yeah. Other veterans went out and bought credit monitoring services. So these suits that are going forward, it looks like, will be issued class action.
Fascinating. Yep. Larry Scott, and you can read all about that, plus what Senator Larry Craig is up to, taking aim at the least deserving veterans. An amazing story. Read all about it over at VAWatchdog.org. Larry Scott, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you again, Tom.
Good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour on the program where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, not a chance. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
A song will lift as the mainsail shifts and the boat drifts onto the shoreline. And the sun will respect every face on the deck the hour that the ships come in. Then the sands will roll out a carpet of gold for your weary toes to be a-touching. And the ship's wise men will remind you once again that the whole wide world is watching.
And welcome back. Yeah, that's the problem. The whole wide world is watching the United States and saying, why aren't we doing something about the violence in the Middle East? Why aren't we doing something to support the democracy in Lebanon, a struggling and fragile democracy? Why aren't we doing something? On it goes. Anyway, welcome back to our program. 35 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And time now for a Catherine Harris alert.
Well, if we make this coat, it would be as if I were wearing your dog.
Yes. Catherine Harris has taken back 100,000 of the $3.5 million she gave her campaign for Senate. This, according to CBS and the Associated Press, the reason she's going to finish renovating her home in Washington, D.C. Yeah, it looks like the Catherine Harris campaign is going down in flames. This is another way of saying it. Not quoting the Associated Press here. Well, back to the AP. Harris lost much of her core staff for the second time since getting in the race last summer. Her campaign manager, Glenn Hodes, resigned after 3 months on the job, saying Harris was uncontrollable. Also said she hasn't kept any of her promises about her behavior, including her promise not to have tantrums, not to berate staff, not to micromanage a nitpick, and not to get flustered on inconsequential details. Man, you got a candidate, and these are the promises that they have to make to their staff, and then she fails to keep them, and the staff... I'd say that Bill Nelson, the Democrat in Florida, who is going to be running against Catherine Harrison in November, probably a pretty good day at his campaign. Probably a very good day. The White House, this over at thinkprogress.org, the White House website violates federal law. This is, you know, kind of one of those small things, unless you happen to be visually impaired or blind, in which case it's a very big deal. The Section 508 of the Rehabilitation Act requires that federal agencies' websites have attached to photographs a text tag, a little kind of, it's not quite a meta tag, it's a text tag, that identifies what the picture is of. So if somebody can't see the picture, they can mouse over that and you know, read the text or hear the text or feel the text if they're using a Braille machine, and it'll tell them what the picture is of. And they point out, to the over at thinkprogress.org, they point out that the White House is not in compliance with the law. They're just not doing it. Well, my solution to this is really simple. I just don't go to whitehouse.gov. That's the official White House website. I go to the unofficial White House website at whitehouse.org and, get my news about the White House there. It's actually more straightforward and honest than the, at least, you know, from the kind of Fox News White House Karl Rove point of view, than is the information over at whitehouse.gov. Go to whitehouse.org, for example. Today's headline. A 2006 G8 summit, President Bush presents brilliantly insightful and nuanced ideas to eliminate world's thorniest problems. And so then on the Israeli-Lebanon conflict, what they need to do is get Syria to get Hezbollah to stop doing this, beep, and it's over. On birth defects, what doctors need to do is tell fetuses to stop sprouting extra arms and flippers and beep, and it's over. And, it goes on and on like that. So, media alert. Press Secretary Tony Snow releases useful and informative headline helper for the week of July 9 through 15. And here's the list of talking points from Tony Snow that, reporters, don't make the time-consuming drudgery of research and analysis prevent you from making today's deadline. Use Headline Helper to help your readers blissfully marinating in the same patrio-journalism they've come to expect ever since September of 2001. And then they have a few newspapers that have used Tony Snow's Headline Helper. For example, the Jingleville Ledger. Yes. Headline, sudden, totally unforeseeable surge in Middle East violence marks inevitable outcome of failed Clinton foreign policy. Right. Whitehouse.org. They got it figured out. Here's another one. This is from the Red State Journal. Economic miracle. Corporate taxes exceed administration's lowball estimate. Magically erase voter concern over hungry children and $4 gasoline. Here's another one. This is from the Bible Belt Tribune. Incomplete and total non-flip-flop, President magnanimously applies Geneva Conventions to America's compassionate gulag system. And finally, from the Sheeple City Post, Valerie Plame sues Vice President Cheney, subhead, former CIA nobody and hyper-litigious bimbo undermines American security by filing egregiously frivolous lawsuit. So see, you can get, you want to know the White House's view on stuff, just go to whitehouse.org, get the actual, kind of real White House story over there. 39 minutes past the hour. Number 1-866-440-8466-440-THOM. You can drop into our live chat room, of course, also by going to tomhartman.com and click live chat. Dorothy in Eureka, California. Hey, Dorothy, welcome to the program. Dorothy?
Oh, hi.
Hey, is it true about what they say about Eureka on the TV? I've been seeing these ads that say Eureka is like this really strange place.
Well, I feel that brilliant. I don't know about the rest of them. But,
okay, there you go.
What I want to know is your take on, you alerted me to this NAFTA superhighway a couple of weekends ago.
Yeah, with the caveat that it was Jerome Corzine, the guy who was the co-founder of the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth, who alerted everybody in America to this. He's the guy who first publicized this.
Well, just how real is it? Because I'm very concerned about that.
Yeah. Well, apparently it's real and it's not real. This is, I've been following this thing, and apparently there is a plan to organize the highway, the existing highway systems, and perhaps add to them. There's actually a website for this, a .gov website. I don't have it right in front of me. I'm sorry, so I can't give you the URL. But perhaps somebody in the chat room will grab that thing and pass it along to me before we wrap up this segment. And what they will do is basically allow stuff across the border very easily and very quickly, and have border stations somewhere closer to the center of the United States, like in Kansas. and they will organize existing highways, I guess Route 35 through Texas, if that's one of them, and others, and then there will be some pieces added to it. And the whole plan is to be able to offload Chinese goods and other goods, but primarily Chinese goods, in Mexico without using longshoremen, and ship them into the United States without using Teamsters. And it's really part of the larger plan that is NAFTA, and is this whole unification. This came out of a meeting a year and a half ago between Bush and Harper and Fox, Vicente Fox in Mexico, down in Waco, the Waco Accords or whatever it's called, to basically create the North American Free Trade Agreement, North America, whatever you call it, thing. Does that make sense?
I find it really scary, and hardly anybody has heard about it. I called my my two senators and my congressman. I got an email back from him, and it was sort of extolling the virtues of the security borders.
Yeah.
And
as far as I know, in the mainstream media, the only other, you know, I talked about it, and I put out the caveat that it was Jerome Corsi who was first, you know, flogging this thing. And, you know, his political agenda is sometimes very hard for me to figure out. And I almost, you know, you almost wonder who's writing the check this week. I just don't know. You know, Lou Dobbs is the other one who's been talking about it, and been talking about it quite a bit, actually, on his television program. To the best of my knowledge, though, I haven't seen it pretty much anywhere else. I-35 is from the Rio Grande Valley to the Canadian border, says Placidus Roy over at our chat room. And the website that I'm looking for is the .gov website. There's actually a .gov website that talks about this highway, and we'll see if we can track that down for you.
Okay.
Dorothy.
Thank you very much.
Sure. Appreciate the call. And again, it seems like, you know, on the one hand, this might be just the implementation of something that has basically been law since Bill Clinton pushed this thing through. And, you know, the final implementation of it. Or it might be some, you know, very substantial, very new, very large, you know, big deal. And we'll just have to see, you know, how it all shakes out, how it all breaks out, or, you know, whatever the proper phrase is. By the way, the word is, I wrote an op-ed piece a week or so ago that was on commondreams.org about how we need to be talking about, you know, it's the spying on Democrats, stupid. In other words, you know, every time there's a discussion. Yeah, in fact, here's the piece by Jerome Corsi. This was published June 21st, 2006. The Trans-Texas Corridor is ready to begin. I'm changing subjects here. It's back to the TTC. It's ready to begin construction in 2007. Building the first segment is what is planned to be a NAFTA superhighway. It'll ultimately proceeding north to Kansas City via Oklahoma City and connecting Canada with Canadian limited access highways north of Duluth, Minnesota. This is based on the March 11, 2005 Comprehensive Development Agreement that was signed by the Texas Department of Transportation, et cetera. And it's actually, a lot of this has been outsourced to yesterday we were talking about the Spanish company that's buying up toll roads, buying up roads all across the United States and turning them into toll roads. And there's a quarterwatch.org is the website that you can find all this stuff at. But you know, how, to what extent this is going to be some radical change, or as opposed to simply, you know, we're already seeing, I mean, you know, GM shutting down factories and moving to Mexico, to what extent it's one or the other, I think is still going to depend on how this gets implemented. And that's going to depend on what kind of political noise gets made between now and the middle of next year. And that's going to depend on whether the media picks it up. I mean, look at what happened with the Dubai ports deal. They thought that was a done deal, and now it's not. Now, there's a similar one, the Oman trade deal, or the Oman, you know, the Oman version of the Dubai ports deal. There's a very similar one coming down the road, right now coming out of Oman. So, you know, we'll see how that shakes out. As I mentioned just a few minutes ago, as we started to get into, the whole idea of the government spying on Democrats as opposed to spying on everybody, this from... dailycal.org, newly surfaced government surveillance reports reveal that the U.S. Department of Defense monitored anti-war and anti-military emails sent by UC Berkeley students in April. See, I'm telling you, they're spying on the anti-war movement. They're spying on Democrats. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
This is... is the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom, your master's at war. You that build the big guns. You that build the death planes. You that build all the bombs. You that hide behind walls. You that hide behind disks. I just want you to know I can see through your masks.
And welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The pill that will help you escape the matrix. The Tom Hartman radio program. Okay, here's the website, and thanks to the folks in the chat room for digging this thing out. Much appreciated. We have some of the just the finest minds in the universe listening to this program, and many of them hanging out in our chat room. And this is from Stray Karma. The website is www.spb.gov. SPP, as in Sugar Peter, and that. What it stands for is Security and Prosperity Partnership. .gov. This is an official U.S. government website. And it's the Security and Prosperity Partnership of North America. It says, here's the text, the Security and Prosperity Partnership of North America was launched in March of 2005. This was the meeting. The meeting in 2005 was that meeting in Waco, Texas that I was telling you about with George Bush and I believe it was Stephen Harper of Canada and Vicente Fox of Mexico, back to the website, as a trilateral effort to increase security and enhance prosperity among the United States, Canada, and Mexico through greater cooperation and information sharing. And this trilateral initiative is premised on our security and our economic prosperity being mutually reinforcing. In other words, if our corporations are doing well, then we're safe. If you buy that, I've got a bridge in Brooklyn for you. But anyhow, this is what they say. The SPP recognizes that our three great nations are bound by a shared belief in freedom, economic opportunity, and strong democratic institutions. Well, sort of. Mexico actually is kind of bound by an oligarchy, you know, very, very wealthy families. If you dig a little deeper into this website, you come up with a rather lengthy document. I'm looking at page 24 of it online, and it's... signature initiative, safer, faster, and more efficient border crossings. Use newer enhanced mechanisms to support border planning, information sharing, and communications. And revitalize the Canada-U.S. Transportation Border Working Group and the U.S.-Mexico Joint Working Committee on Transportation Planning by the end of 2005. Now, these are goals that they've set. So this was by the end of last year. Complete a Canadian-U.S. border infrastructure compendium and develop an implementation plan for priority infrastructure investments at key land border ports of entry by 2008. Conduct ongoing consultation as appropriate with stakeholders, including the Mexican Secretariat of Communications and Transportation and U.S. Trade Development Administration. Initiate new studies on the main NAFTA corridors between Mexico and the U.S. and develop a methodology to relieve bottlenecks within the highway network and at ports of entry by mid-2006. So that's presumably what they're working on right now. And like I said, the government isn't talking about it much, and neither is the mainstream media. But it's fascinating, and if you want to check the whole thing out, the official website, you can read it. It's the Security and Prosperity Partnership of North America, SPP, as in Security and Prosperity Partnership, spp.gov.gov. And it's official U.S. government website. So now, it's not something that Jerome Corsi made up, but how it plays out may or may not be a big deal. What it really boils down to is the end of tariffs. And, you know, we've been through that rift before. Jim in Maple Valley, Washington. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind today?
Tom, I wanted to talk about the stem cell issue first, and then I'm running for political office, and I wanted to mention that if I could as well.
Sure. Well, Jim, we only have about 2 minutes, so cross out your website for running for political office first. Let's get the plug out of the way.
I don't have a website, but I'm running against Dandy Dave Reichert up here in Washington State. He's a Republican and a rubber stamp for Mr. Bush. I'm a Vietnam veteran, a Marine, and Reichert certainly doesn't help the veterans in any way. Nor
well, Jim, let me encourage you really strongly to get a website together so that we can share it with our listeners. It's
I'll
a great way that people can contribute money and time and effort to you. Now, what's your last name, by the way, Jim?
Curtis.
Jim Curtis.
C-U-R-T-I-S.
Okay, are you going to be the Democratic candidate or are you running as an independent?
I'm an independent. I'm also a member of the VFW up here in the 1st Marine Division Association.
Great. Okay, and you called and said you wanted to talk about stem cells.
Well, yeah, no one's mentioned the benefit that this stem cell research could have as far as the veterans that have been crippled in Iraq and Afghanistan. And, you know, everybody, a lot of veterans think that Bush supports the troops.
Right.
Well, you know, here's a great way to support the troops by promoting the stem cell research.
Right, particularly for those with spinal cord injuries.
Right, exactly.
Isn't that off the air? Yeah, no, you can't say it on the air. And you know, I'm assuming the guys in New York dropped it. But it's, yeah, it's, at least I don't think you could say it on the air. In any case, yeah, the George W. Bush. Yes, we're going to cause spinal cord injuries in Iraq, but we're not going to do anything with stem cells to heal them, to help them, to fix them. No, that ain't going to happen here in the United States. Very, very strange stuff going on. Very strange stuff going on. And George W. Bush, he's apparently signed this veto now this afternoon. If he hasn't by now, well, he probably has by now. He's heading on over to Congress. And I'm telling you, it's just going to give the Republicans who are in trouble something to run against Bush on the next election. Coming up tomorrow, Congressman Ron Paul, a Republican from Texas, is going to tell us how the Fed has doubled our money supply in the last 10 years. Tune in to find out how this is a disaster in the making. And David Sanders, our Taking Our Country Back segment, running for Congress in the 4th Congressional District of Indiana. Remember, my friends, activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for